Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Accessible Technology Webinar Series. I'm Janet Peters. I'm a coordinator with the Great Lakes ADA Center. The Accessible Technology Webinar Series is sponsored by the Great Lakes ADA Center and by the Pacific ADA Center. Both are members of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is comprised of 10 regional centers across the country and is funded by the National Institute of Disability and Rehabilitation Research. We're glad you're here today for this session. I think we'll start with a few housekeeping items. This webinar is being recorded and will be available and archived on the Accessible Technology webinar website page. The session has real-time captioning available. The closed captioning icon on the top menu towards the left side is available to turn the captioning on and off, where you can resize your captioning window. You can also select the captioning window by pressing Control F8. We'll be monitoring the chat window for questions during the session. If your question isn't answered during the session, we will have a time at the end of the session for questions and answers. So hang tight, your question will get answered. Today's session is an update on accessible technology, information and communication technology. And we're very pleased to have speaker Jim Tobias with us, who is an expert in this area. Jim has 30 years of experience in accessible and usable technology in both public and private sectors. He has focused on how technologies are designed and used in education, employment, and civic participation. Jim has a master's degree in industrial design and is president of Inclusive Technologies, a technology analysis consulting firm specializing in accessible information and communication technologies. He has served on several advisory committees, including co-chairing the Access Board Committee on Updating Accessibility Requirements in Section 255 and Section 508. Jim is co-director of the Accessibility Element of California's Review of Voting Technologies in 2007 and 2008. He led the user testing component of that committee. He chaired the Alliance for Telecom Industry Solutions Interactive Voice Response Accessibility Forum, and he has participated in the April 2008 meeting of the Global Initiative for Inclusive Information and Communication Technology. As I mentioned, we're very happy to have Jim presenting today. He will take questions throughout the session, so feel free to type your questions in the chat area, and we will have a question and answer at the end. And with that, Jim, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks a lot, Janet. Just want to make sure that I'm being heard okay. Assume that I am, unless I see differently in the chat window. I'm very grateful to have this opportunity and very happy to have everyone showing up this afternoon. Looks like a nice size audience. Of course, I'm not sure exactly what all your interests are in particular, and what your level of awareness is on what's going on in mainstream ICT accessibility policy. So any questions that you want to have or comments that you want to add into the chat window will help me fine-tune the presentation during it. So let's give you an idea of what I'll be covering. The first is, you know, why? Why are we bothering with mainstream ICT policy? And hopefully have some good answers for you regardless of what your job responsibilities are. Then a little bit of a historical context of how we got to where we are right now and what's going on right now. And we've got major initiatives really across the board, the ADA Section 508, the Communication and Video Accessibility Act and Section 255, Section 503, and then a number of other activities, some of which are not laws and regulations, but they're definitely policy-oriented, very often starting at the federal level. Then I'm going to close it out with a plea for wider participation in the policy world, and hopefully cover some of the specific issues and some of the general trends that are going on out there. So first off, why is mainstream ICT policy important to us? And I don't think it's a secret to anyone who's involved in the modern world that, you know, what I'm using here is the word permeation, is you almost can't do anything anymore without some sort of ICT connection. So if you looked at the number of banking transactions, for example, that are done through an ATM or banking online, you'll see that it's creeping up to 85 and 90% of even consumer banking is now being done electronically. And we don't remember the names of the tellers anymore at the banks because we're doing everything automatically. And that's happening across the board, not just in banking, but in entertainment, employment, education, voting, commerce, civic engagement of all types, obviously peer interactions, social networking, et cetera. So being able to use ICT is more and more an important part of everyday life. Within that trend, we're seeing personalization and self-service. That is, we're not expecting a company to set everything up for us and help us work for it. We're increasingly having to rely on our own technology knowledge or our peers, families, and friends to help us set up our ICT and make it work. And it's highly customized to our own personal needs. So that's going on as well, and of course there's an accessibility implication there. If you can personalize the ICT and set up the features and the settings the way you want it, and if the choices are broad enough, then people with disabilities are going to be served. If those choices are too narrow and too aimed at some presumption of what an average performance is, then people with disabilities are going to be excluded. The other thing that's very important to keep in mind, and we obviously see this every day as well, is how disruptive mainstream ICT is. It's an extremely rapid pace where new products are coming in every day, new versions of products are replacing old versions every day, and there's just a profusion of options out there. If you think about, let's say 10 years ago, how you would be sending text, you might have one or two main options, email and let's say SMS on a mobile phone. Now if you consider how you're able to send and receive text, there are literally hundreds of options, many of which are very popular, many of which are niche oriented. You may use, you know, Facebook to keep in touch with some people, LinkedIn to keep in touch with other people, still be texting other people. There's a real sense in which there's an ecosystem of usage, and that is dominating how we are using technology now. And the issues of accessibility, with all of that speed and volume of usage, and of course the constantly declining costs, in some cases zero cost, have a disruptive effect on accessibility. Those of us who come from an assistive technology background where we could kind of rely on standalone assistive technology that really wouldn't change radically from one year to the next are buffeted by the winds of change in the mainstream world. New products that our assistive technology is supposed to stay compatible with, new features in those products that tend to erode the value or the necessity of an assistive technology solution, makes the entire enterprise of a separate domain of technology just for people with disabilities, it makes that domain very shaky. It jeopardizes the sustainability of assistive technology. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that we have to pay attention to mainstream ICT accessibility. We don't really have an option anymore. It's not something that we can just let develop on its own and then hope that they're going to have accessibility or compatibility features for what we need over on our side of the fence, because the fence isn't there. The fence has, you know, been knocked down and burned down by what's going on in the mainstream world. But that doesn't in any way mean that the skills that made the assistive technology sector so valuable are no longer valuable. In fact, they're needed more than they were before. If you have had an experience of talking with someone from mainstream company, even a technical person, even a usability person or a designer, you'll see that they really don't automatically understand what accessibility is about. They don't understand the situation and the use environment of people with disabilities. It's not an automatic skill. And of course, on the side of trying to identify what solutions are going to work best for a given individual in a given environment of use, folks from the mainstream don't really have a strength there. So they need our expertise. So the challenge to us is, how do we make that work? How do we, in this eroding and disrupted interface between two types of technology, how do we keep alive the companies and the professional skills that are so valuable in the world of assistive technology? So I guess over the last 10 years or so in the policy world, our goals have been, on the one hand, to try to maximize the accessibility in mainstream ICT products. That is, one way or the other, encourage mainstream companies to pay attention to this issue and to do whatever it is that they can reasonably do to make accessibility a built-in part of their products. And then supplementary to that, and out of necessity, what can be done to keep AT and AT-oriented services alive and, in fact, growing and thriving. So that's, I think, the framework for what I hope to be able to communicate to you this afternoon. So looking back, and we can really go back into the 1960s and 1970s before the ADA, we already had a number of initiatives in the policy world, many of which began in the world of broadcast and telecommunications, because you had the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, which was regulating a monopoly both in the television world and in the telephone world. And it was therefore somewhat amenable to lobbying on behalf of consumers from a number of perspectives. And so what we had was the Television Captioning Decoder Act, which required built-in captioning decoder capabilities in televisions above a certain size, and laws for hearing aid compatibility, and laws for requiring TTYs to be available in public sector organizations, and you know, kind of a slow but steady progress as technology itself took over more and more of the realm of everyday life. And of course, the big inflection point was the passage of the ADA, which had implicit and explicit connections to accessibility. It's not generally known, but it was Title IV of the ADA, which established the requirement for relay service, telecommunication relay service, at that time called Deaf Relay. And of course, the other parts of the ADA, as an anti-discrimination act, didn't only aim at attitudes and actions of discrimination on the part of educators or employers, but it actually required physical changes to the environment that we noticed over the years subsequent to the ADA having a powerful inclusive effect. And as we've gone since the passage of the ADA in 1990, we've seen more and more attempts to use it to build a technology on-ramp, and we'll be talking about where we're at with that now. 1996 was the passage of the Telecom Act, and Section 255 of the Telecom Act was really the first technology accessibility explicit law and the regulations following it. It's really quite an interesting and very short section in the law, and the regulations are kind of nice and elegant and short as well. They lay out the situations and the descriptions of the functional limitations of people with disabilities and require telecommunications products and services to be accessible. And it was really the model for all of the subsequent laws and even the public standards for technology. Section 508 had been in the Rehab Act since 1973, I think, maybe 1978, but there had really been no teeth in it until passage of it in 1998, at which point Section 508 became kind of a new hook to hang accessibility requirements on it, and be going into some detail on where we are at with 508 and where we're going to be. And then the most recent legal change is the 21st Century Communication and Video Accessibility Act, which was passed in 2010. We've been in the mode of, I think, 13 separate regulatory proceedings coming out of that act, extremely intensive source of new regulations. So right now, we're in a, I would say, kind of a high point of developing and new implementation of regulations. Some of these are refreshment of existing laws and regulations, and some of them are brand new. You may be aware that the Rehab Act was introduced, I guess, yesterday or the day before yesterday in the Senate as part of the Workforce Investment Act, and there are some going to be some changes, not clear exactly right now yet on the specifics of the technology-oriented sections of the Act, but that's going to be something we'll be paying attention to. In addition to the specific laws and regulations, there's an awful lot of policy work in research and development. Understand the technological implications of the policies and pushing policies onward. We, of course, have programs like the Tech Act Project and program and others that have to do with accessible technology that come with a policy understanding. And we have especially the development of information resources with a recognition that sometimes there's plenty of technology out there, but we just can't find out about it. We can't find which one we want and which one is going to be best for us to use in a given situation. So there's a lot going on. To get specific about the ADA, what we've had from the Department of Justice a couple of years ago were some advanced notice of proposed rulemakings. That's ANPRM. And four of them came out all at the same time. Two of the most important on the on that list there are for web accessibility and for equipment accessibility. The two middle ones are a little bit more narrowly focused on movies and on 911 service, but I'll be talking about the web and equipment one. So those ANPRMs came out. And they got, just to go into a little bit of background, what a regulatory agency typically does is it writes up questions that it has about rules that it might want to implement. And it hopes to get comments from all of the interested parties. So it puts out an advance notice of proposed rulemaking and says, tell us what you think about this. We're thinking of doing X. What do you think? What would be the implications? Why should we do it? Why shouldn't we do it? And it collects a lot of responses from the public, from companies, from agencies, from concerned individuals of one sort or another. And then it takes those and rethinks the potential rules and then generally issues a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is a more concrete, more explicit idea of what the rule is going to be. There's another cycle of commenting and replies. And then the regulatory agency issues a final rule of some form, which is what the actual enforceable regulations are. So where we're at with the ADA, is that we've been promised by the end of July, which is drawing nigh, that there will be Title II, Notice of Proposed Rulemakings on Title II for those topics. So for we'll see a proposed rules about public sector websites and equipment operated or installed in a public sector location. So that would be, you know, city and county or educational institution websites, or let's say medical equipment at a municipal clinic, you know, on the equipment side. Then in December, we've been promised Title III proposed rules, and that's really going to be a big impact, because Title III is the public accommodations title in the ADA, and that basically means every business, every location, every stadium, store, parking lot, you know, literally everything out there in the private sector that serves the public would be covered by those proposed rules. So this is the result of a long struggle with issues principally about web accessibility. You may be familiar that even once we had enough usage of the web for accessibility to rise as an important issue, we had attempts to use the ADA to enforce web accessibility. But the court cases that came down pretty consistently said that ADA didn't apply to the web. It applied to what you call brick and mortar accommodations. That is, it was a store that that was inaccessible, not an online presence. And there were some little fine points in there, but mostly it was not allowed to be a way to complain about web accessibility. What's important to keep in mind is that the Department of Justice, throughout this entire period under the you know, previous administration and as well as the current one, opposed this view and did consider the web to be equivalent to a public accommodation, so that, you know, when you had an airline offering a special price for an online purchase of a ticket, but the website was inaccessible, well, that was an actual damage to a disabled passenger who couldn't take advantage of that discount. So that was the thinking throughout. So you might think of the Department of Justice as feeling, you know, a gathering momentum to make sure that the web got included in the ADA framework. So when this Notice of Proposed Rulemaking comes out, we'll probably find that the Department of Justice agrees with the general trend towards harmonization to WCAG 2.0 AA level. Now, if that's obscure to you, WCAG is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, and 2.0 is the second version of it, and there are three possible levels of compliance, and AA is the medium level. This may have some interpretation based on what the Access Board is doing, which is also aiming at harmonizing with WCAG 2.0 in its Section 508 proceeding. So those two are, it's not clear exactly what the timing is going to be. I wouldn't say they're each waiting for the other, but there's a lot of, I think, behind the scenes discussions about what the timing is going to be and what the application of these guidelines is actually going to be. So we may see also in a clarification in these proposed rules about, first of all, it will have to say by what date, let's say a website in either public sector or later private sector, by what date it has to be accessible, and what to do about old content, which is an issue that often gets raised you know, a lot of entities have content, you know, scanned documents, and do they have to take those scanned documents and make them accessible? So there'll be some clarification about that. There'll be clarification about what constitutes a public accommodation. That's a generally understood term, but there may be some room for interpretation as to what it means for web accessibility. We could have a whole afternoon talk just about that as we consider the various things that wouldn't ever have been thought of as public accommodations, but now are crucial to the use of the web and therefore, you know, much of our lives. And the same clarification process is going to have to happen with respect to the burden. What is the expected level of investment or expense or cost or delay that an entity might be expected to do under web accessibility rules? So I hope as I'm reading these things off and explaining them that it's coming across clearly and intelligibly, but I'm also hoping that you're thinking of, well, gee, I have something to say about that. I think that undue burden should be ignored, or everything should be considered public accommodation, or whatever it is you're coming up with, because again, later I'm going to be making a pitch for you to be actively involved in this. So on the equipment side, most of the items listed in the previous ANPRM were not ICT objects. They were like exam tables. But we know from a separate proceeding that ATMs were covered under special new ADA rules that went into effect a couple of years ago. So the implication here is that one of the things the Department of Justice may do is to create a kind of category of devices that are like ATMs but for other purposes. So these would be all kinds of transaction devices, anything like an ATM, like that point of sale terminal at your supermarket, or a transit ticket machine, anything that lets you buy something with a card or with some sort of interface. That it might also apply to communication devices, and this is sensitive because it's an area where the FCC generally has jurisdiction, but there are all kinds of communication modalities now that are not traditional telecommunications, and so the Department of Justice may feel a need to supplement FCC regulations. And then they may take a maximalist perspective and say, well, look, anything that has a user interface, any piece of ICT that a person is expected to use that is connected to or essential to whatever the entity is offering. So, you know, if this is the furthest out example is a candy machine. You know, you're at a hotel and you've got a room, and outside there in the hallway there's a candy machine or a soda machine, and it does have a user interface, and some of them are really quite sophisticated and getting to look more and more like computers, and is that something that would be covered? So that may show up in the ADA NPRMs. So where are we at with Section 508, which you may be familiar with, is the part of the Rehab Act that requires federal agencies to purchase accessible ICT. Not only purchase it, but when they develop ICT, when an agency makes its own website, when it maintains that website, or when any ICT product is used in the course of agency activities, like sending email or creating a document. And you may be aware that Section 508 has been adopted by many other entities in the public sector, states and municipalities and universities and school districts and what have you. So it's permeated certainly the procurement side of ICT in the public sector. And it's built with six product categories, which are now showing signs of age, so that there's a separate one for software and separate one for web. And we're now familiar with web and software kind of mingling as web apps and mobile apps. In addition to their separate categories, it has functional performance criteria that basically say how this product must be able to be used by a person who is blind, a person who has low vision, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes through the functional limitation categories. And then it also covers not just the product itself, but how the product is documented and how it's supported. So it went into effect back in June 2001 with a set of regulations that were germane at the time, but now are a little bit out of date. And one of the things that it presumes is that there's some way to find out about the accessibility of the product. And this raises the information resource side of accessible ICT policy. That is, how do we communicate about accessibility? And how do we inform ourselves and query vendors about accessibility? And the tool that's currently in use is called a VPAT, or Voluntary Product Accessibility Template. Some variants of it in the federal government are called GPATs, or Government Product Accessibility Template, clarifying that it's not voluntary. If the federal customer insists on it, then the vendor has to provide it. So that's an element of Section 508. Where we're at right now with it is that we had an advisory committee that struggled for 2 years to look at where we would need to change the 508 regulations, and we think we came up with some very good solutions and certainly aimed very clearly at harmonizing with the WCAG guidelines so that vendors and developers would not be confused. They wouldn't say, as many do now, well, 508 is telling me to do this, and WCAG is telling me to do that, and Australia is telling me to do something else, and our goal was to globally harmonize and clarify what the actual requirements were. So since the advisory committee met and completed its work, the Access Board has issued two ANPRMs about Section 508. An awful lot of detail in their questions and in the answers that they got back from the public. I think they had something like 400 comments, which is, I think, something like 5 or 10 times more than they had ever had on a proceeding. Really significant amount of detail went back and forth. And that has, I think, sort of slowed the picture down a little bit. We haven't had a new version of 508 as quickly as we might have wanted. The Access Board isn't the only active entity in the 508 world. The law actually requires the Department of Justice to do a study every 2 years of how well the federal agencies are implementing Section 508 and what the status of accessible ICT is in the federal government. And that just came out last fall. Definitely worth reading, not always a tale of good news. There's a lot of signs of, you know, the difficulty of implementing what's really a subtle, and I think those of us from the world of accessibility and even from a clinical world will at least have a sly smile on our faces as we see the difficulties that basically untrained federal purchasing agents, the difficulty that they have trying to interpret what the needs of a given person with a disability or generic concept of disability might be with respect to some ICT product. It's not an easy or obvious thing. In addition to the Department of Justice report, the Obama administration early on recognized that it needed to kind of supercharge 508 and make it work a little bit better. So the Office of Management and Budget worked on a report on how do we improve kind of at a meta level? How do we improve Section 508? What are the problems and what can we do about them? And that is a really excellent report to read. I would encourage you to look at it and study it, because it is going to be the framework for a series of actions to improve accessibility throughout the federal public sector, and I think it'll have ramifications outside. So the themes that they came up with, I think, are all valuable. One is transparency, so that whatever information there is about 508 should be shared more widely, should be more obvious when a company is making a claim about it, accessibility of its product. We need to know about it when there's a response to that. We need to know about that as well. When there's a purchase or a failure to purchase or non-purchase of a product, it'd be nice to know that as well. Accountability, the agencies need to straighten out their how they manage 508 so that it's clear what is being decided and who's responsible for which decisions, and how decisions about undue burden are being made. And collaboration, especially at the federal level, where you have literally dozens of agencies with you might say sibling experts in accessibility who don't quite have the tools yet for sharing their information, for asking each other questions, for communicating with vendors kind of en masse, back and forth to advance accessibility without making it burdensome to anybody. So I think there's if there's one reading outcome I would like you to have after today, it would be to look at that report. So we're expecting, and the word expecting might be in quotes because it has been delayed a number of times, unfortunately, we're expecting a 508 NPRM by the end of this year, which means that given the cycle of responses, we might have a final rule by the middle of next year. And if there's a 6-month effective date delay, the new rules would go into effect by the end of next year or early 2015. I don't think there's anybody in the process who's happy with the long delay, but I think we're ready to move to the next version of Section 508. And as I said, we'll probably see this focusing largely on WCAG 2.0. One interesting piece is that WCAG is the web content accessibility guidelines, and not everything is the web, even though sometimes it seems like it. There's a lot of ICT out there that isn't the web. So if we were to say, the interface on the panel of a copying machine, that's not the web, but there's an awful lot of similar issues. If you look at how the accessibility of that panel might affect a person with one disability or another, the impacts are very much the same. So one good thing that the Web Accessibility Initiative has done is what they call WCAG to ICT, which was a working group that's only about midway finished with its final deliverable, which is a way of interpreting WCAG for other types of ICT, be they phones or ATMs or anything that's not web. It's very much focused on documents, but it also has implications for other kinds of devices. So then we had in 2010 the passage of the 21st Century Communication and Video Accessibility Act. So the purpose of CVAA was to update the rules for Section 255, which applied only to the, or largely to the non-digital world, the conventional world of the telephone, the fax machine. Remember, this is 1996. We're talking about web usage is pretty low. People are using email and they're using text pagers, but they're not using any of those kind of media the way we are now. So there was a need to update it and create a level playing field so that whether you were digital and web-based or traditional and copper-based or cable or whatever, everybody was going to be subject to the same kind of regulations for all of the domains that the FCC controls. Since the passage of the bill, as I said, there's been almost a feverish development of regulations, and at one point the FCC had this calendar that showed, you know, what was going on, and in the, you know, more than a dozen domains within the Act. And I'm not going to go into each and every one of them, because that again would be you know, kind of a whole afternoon's worth of content for probably not a heck of a lot of value. From a consumer perspective, or, you know, a client perspective, or a consumer advocacy perspective, I think what's important to keep in mind is that CVAA is aimed at requiring accessibility in areas where it hadn't been required before, especially in the wireless domain, but also in the TV and emergency services domain, and I'll go into a little more detail. So it's going to be a great way for us to advocate and communicate with the people who operate our emergency services, as well as our cable companies and our TV manufacturers and what have you. So most of the provisions are in place. A few more are coming online this October, and they're all, at least I think, they succeeded in creating that level playing field for digital and non-digital media. I won't go into the couple of other details that are down here. Move on to exactly what CVAA covers. So it's got captioning, video description, emergency communications, advanced communication services, I'll go into in a little detail, accessible equipment, and some miscellaneous provisions. So for captioning, it restores the balance and says if your show is a digital show, it's got to have captioning just as analog broadcast TV did. And the rules there are 100% of new programming and 75% of old programming, with some exemptions and waivers for low volume broadcasters, religious broadcasters, and things like that. And the captioning has to be available on all screens. Previously, we had that captioning decoder act that said TVs bigger than 13 inches had to have captioning, and now we've got, you know, every screen that you have can show video on it, so we've got to be able to have captioning on every screen. For online videos, and this is an important one because it's sometimes misunderstood, it doesn't apply to things like YouTube. You don't have to put captions if you're going to put a video up online only. You don't have to put captions on there. Of course, it's a good practice to do so, but CVAA doesn't require you. The only programs online that have to be captioned are ones that have been broadcast with captions already. So these are regular TV shows that then have a second existence as online videos. And I hope that's clear. Video description, one of the problems that we had with some legal action after the Telecom Act was that the rules for video description were thrown out by a district court as burdensome. So basically CVAA came back and said, we're going to make this a law that we have video description for at least some of the content that's out there. Those of you who aren't familiar with video description, it's the insertion of a description of whatever's important on the screen during a silent portion in the audio. And you may have experienced this in the second audio program or other videos that have a little bit of stuff telling you what some silent on-screen action is about. So there are requirements for the top broadcasting networks and the top markets. And there's an exemption for live or near live video content. And all of the hours and the expectations of the broadcasters and broadcast networks expand over time, and I think that goes out to 2019 and just gets larger and larger. Emergency communications is a key area of advocacy and a key area of jeopardy for people with disabilities. So CBA took a lot of time to attend to those issues, and it really covers a number of points. First of all of the equipment that's used for emergency alerting, and that could be your TV set that has a storm warning on it. All of that equipment has to be able to generate emergency communications messages. So your TV, has to be able to deliver whatever emergency alerting signals and tones. Same thing with your, any equipment that's being used for emergency alerting. Similarly, the content that is being broadcast or being sent one way or another to alert consumers about an emergency, that has to be accessible. So we can't have a sound-only warning. We can't have a crawler only on the screen. We have to have accessible content. And there's a number of ways of doing that, and there's some very creative and, I think, effective designs out there that were all driven by the requirements in CBAA. Another very useful innovation that's coming online as early as, it's already available in some places, but it's coming online as early as, I think, April of next year, is the ability to send a text to 911. So any text-capable mobile device that you have, you'll be able to text into 911 and get a text reply and, have the same kind of 911 service that you have traditionally by voice. So advanced communication services are a category within CBAA that is kind of a little bit of a patchwork category. It includes voice over internet protocol. And finally takes companies like Skype and what have you, and has them contribute to the relay fund that provides traditional relay and video relay and speech-to-speech relay services. Advanced communication services also include electronic messaging, which is subdefined to include email, text messaging, and chat. So this is all real-time messaging. This is stuff that you send back and forth. Even though the retrieval of it, like with email, may not be immediate. It also includes what they call interoperable video conferencing, which is actually we're on a service right now that that is going to be covered by CBAA. Capabilities. If you can do more than one-way video, whatever platform that is, for collaboration, for teamwork, for co-entertainment is this new term of everybody's there and you see a show, but you also see the other people who are watching the show. All of those interfaces are going to require accessibility, and that's going to mean the same thing that we expect on the web. It's going to mean being able to control and operate the interfaces by keyboard only. It's going to mean text wherever there's audio. It's going to mean some visual ability of rendering the spoken portion of the program, so captioning and description and what have you, and it's going to apply across the board to any hardware that's involved, any software, and any network services. So accessible equipment constitutes another portion of CBAA, and it basically kind of cuts in the other dimension, if you will. So I was talking about captioning before as a service that your cable company is going to have to forward to you, the ability to display captions. Well, the TV manufacturers have to serve captions as well. And for those of us who've gotten confused with trying to turn on and off captioning, that's been a problem. And CVAA regulations are going to require that there be an actual button on your remote. So you're going to have a closed captioning button on your remote or some equivalent. So you're not going to have to dive down into the menus to figure out what the heck is, how do you turn captioning on and off. Same thing for the rest of the interface of the video, and this includes set-top boxes as well as TVs and the connected TVs, internet TVs that are popular now. So the channel selection, how to record programs, those interfaces have to be accessible. The electronic program guide, so how you search to find a movie that you want to look for that's being broadcast, or a movie that you want to record, or a movie that you want to stream, all of that must be accessible. And the emergency information as well. The second piece here on mobile phones is that the browsers on mobile phones, Section 255 required the operation of the mobile phone for regular communication purposes already to be accessible. So that was an existing requirement. But now we're doing so much else on our mobile devices. The requirement is going to be that the bundled browsers on the phone that you buy, as you buy it, so whatever your wireless provider has on that phone or whatever the manufacturer of the phone has on it, as the basic browser, that must be accessible. It does not apply to apps or any content. So unfortunately, this is not going to be a way to advocate for better web accessibility, and that's why we need the other piece of the patchwork, the Department of Justice web accessibility rules, to apply to that. So again, it's this constantly advancing, rising bar of accessibility. Another piece of CVAA was to create a new equipment distribution program for deaf-blind consumers. It takes $10 million a year out of the Relay Service Fund, and has set up state programs in, I think, every state at this point, has a certified program to identify potential users and provide them with the equipment that they need for communications. A lot of these are Braille-oriented phone devices that will be used either directly or via Relay in one way or another. And this also is a continuing and advancing program that will probably be taking on new technologies and serving more and more of these users as time goes on. So other things in CVAA are requirements for hearing aid compatibility. A very interesting administrative requirement that I'm hearing from my industry clients is a strong motivation. So one of the innovations in CVAA was to require manufacturers to confirm that they are paying attention to these accessibility requirements, and you have to have an executive level officer of the company sign off on a statement to that effect every year. So those people don't want to get caught short. So they are serving now as good motivators at a very high level for making sure that the company pays attention to accessibility. There's a clearinghouse that was established, an information clearinghouse. And here's another thing that would be worth visiting. The FCC's done a great job of aggregating information about accessible ICT and publishing it on a pretty easy-to-use interface on the FCC website. So I think these slides are going to go out to everyone, and I'd encourage you to take a look at that. They're always looking for comments. They're looking for new content. And I think we have a lot to offer a mainstream regulator like the FCC in improving the information collection and the information delivery, especially. And the CVAA also made complaints easier. So whereas it used to be pretty hard to complain to the FCC about accessibility, it's now gotten a lot simpler. The FCC takes on a role of mediating with the party that you want to complain about, the manufacturer or telephone company or whoever it is, and then they kind of expedite the solution, and if there's no solution forthcoming, then they take an expedited role themselves in solving the problem. So it's a big improvement, and hopefully will attract more participation. So Section 503 is another piece of the Rehab Act, and it applies to federal contractors and basically sets the rules for whatever is being done on disability and accessibility for federal contractors. There were new rules proposed at the end of December 2011, one of which was a 7% target for employment of people with disabilities and a 2% target of employment for people with severe disabilities. From the accessibility side of things, it was didn't have a lot of strong rules or implications. Employers had to document applications they received by people with disabilities and what action was taken, and then what must have a plan for accommodations. There was a lot of pushback from the private sector when this notice of proposed rulemaking came out, especially on the target for employment. And so the rules have been delayed, but it also shows up in the Department of Labor regulatory agenda for something by the end of this month. And as you know, we're in the anniversary week of the ADA, and we've had a number of really interesting things happen recently. I don't know if you're aware of them, but the Louisiana Tech University settled a case about online learning materials, the accessibility of them. And the Sacramento Public Library settled a case on accessible ebook readers. So that was, just became public this week. And we may see more things today or tomorrow. And I guess, Janet, if I can suggest one thing, that maybe next year, if you want to do this again, you might do it the week after the ADA anniversary and maybe catch up on some of the last minute things that happened. So we're expecting final rules on Section 503 by the end of the month. I mentioned the Rehab Act reauthorization. Rehab Act is the home for not just 503 and 508, but it is the home of the Access Board is authorized in the Rehab Act, and many other federal interagency committees and what have you that have to do with accessibility. And a new version of the bill was just submitted, I think, on Tuesday, and Senator Harkin, who's the chair of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, was the lead on that. And you may know Andy Imperato is his staffer on accessibility, and Andy was formerly head of the AAPD. There are a lot of questions about whatever happens in the Senate. It's not likely that the House is going to pass it or pass it without major changes. So we'll all have to stay tuned to that, and I think that's part of what I want you to weigh in on if you can. So what are some of the things that could change? Well, the entire 508 process, how it works and who's responsible, could be revised. The role of the Access Board could be revised, or other characteristics of the Access Board. These interagency policy committees, and I'll talk about one that kind of came up ad hoc that might get a little more play in the next version of the Act. And they might even make an explicit statement about a universal design or harmonization of 508. It's not likely that they would do that, but at one point that was a topic that was under discussion. So what else is going on in public policy? We have a very interesting environment now. You're probably all familiar with cloud computing, the idea of not doing everything on your own desktop or even your own portable device, but using some computer somewhere in the internet that would have access to your data, and it would also have its own application running that you would just kind of hook up to and perform all the operations there, cloud computing. And it's kind of a big deal. Every time you use Gmail or Google Docs or eBay or Facebook or anything else, you're really doing cloud computing. The software isn't on your machine. You're accessing it via the browser. So the National Institute on Standards and Technology is responsible for the federal roadmap on cloud computing. How is the federal government going to adopt and manage this very different model of technology? And many issues to think about, obviously privacy and security and authentication and costs and quality assurance and what have you. And we succeeded in getting accessibility promoted up into that same level of concern. So NIST has a cloud computing accessibility public working group. And we're very happy that it does. They have a lot of leverage. There's a lot of ability to affect the adoption of cloud computing in agencies via what NIST says. Another really great initiative taken about 3 years ago was a development within the CIO Council, which is the group of all of the CIOs, the Chief Information Officers of federal agencies, to create an accessibility committee. And this committee was formed, it's very well chaired and very well staffed, to look at 508 and really beyond 508, all about accessibility from the CIO perspective. And it's important to think about what that means. We can talk about accessibility from an accommodation point of view, from a human resources point of view, from a public engagement point of view, but the people who have the levers for making the technology decisions and who have the greatest leverage with the information technology vendors are those offices and those managers who determine what the agency is going to be using, and that's in the CIO's office. So having an accessibility capability there has been a tremendous benefit to us. It's supplemented what we had in GSA and elsewhere in the federal government. The Department of Labor has established, you're probably familiar with the Office of Disability Employment Policy within Labor, and it's established a new center, the Accessible Technology Action Center, which is going to be oriented towards implementing accessible technology. It's not a technology services group, it is a how do we help people manage? How do we help employers manage the accessibility of their workplace ICT? How do we encourage vendors to create more and more accessible ICT? How do we encourage employees and applicants with disabilities to become expert in and advocate for more accessible ICT? So that's another really positive development on the labor side of things. Other policy area that you may be familiar with is what's called transition to IP or Internet Protocol. And this is allowing the telephone companies to basically unload their copper networks and to move everything over to Internet Protocol. Well, there's a lot of upside to that in the sense of not having to invest in aging and sometimes obsolete infrastructure, but there's a lot of downside as well. Your traditional copper phone never ran out of power because it was always connected. When the power failed in your house, your phone still worked because it was connected to batteries at the phone company central office. So if we convert over to IP and the power goes out, what do we use for communication? How do we make sure that citizens are safe and able to communicate in an emergency like that? And there are dozens of other issues in the transition to IP, and we want to make sure that accessibility is on that table as well. For those of you who are interested in international issues, I can really recommend G3ICT, which is a UN-based organization, comes out of the International Telecommunications Union, and it stands for the Global Initiative on Inclusive ICT. They have basically a rolling global summit on accessible technology that was in Washington last month, and I think it's in Australia for Asia this coming month or next month, and then there's going to be another one in Africa and another one in Europe. And they keep, and it's another website that's definitely worth visiting, they keep, they do their own reports and they keep a repository of policies and practices in accessibility that there's an awful lot to learn from and a lot to contribute to as well. Okay, so here's basically where we're at right now. There's an awful lot of stuff going on. I hope some of it at least that I've spoken about is relevant to you. You know, again, what I'm trying to get across is this is a continuing process. As technology evolves, so does our accessibility approach, both on a technological side and on a human services or organizational side. And there's an awful lot going on right now. We've got political struggles to meet up with. Whenever you talk about regulating the internet, there are certain people who, you know, whose hair catch on fire. Part of my hair catches on fire when I hear it as well. It's a big concern. You want to allow for freedom and innovation, but you also want to guarantee a quality of service to the widest possible population. And there's a way to do that. We just have to kind of dig in and exchange ideas with each other and get organized. The most important part is this harmonization piece, that we'd like to be a planet that has one view of accessibility, the right view, the most inclusive view, and we have the best tools, technological tools and management tools for generating improvements in accessibility and spreading the value of ICT as much as we can, and tracking all of those non-web items that are constantly arising. You know, I don't know if you have the same experience as I do, but when you see a new piece of technology, you can't help but look at it through an accessibility lens, and you know, you generally see an upside and a downside for everything, and our goal, I think, is going to be to try to magnify the upside and reduce and allay the downside as much as we can. It's going to take a lot of continuing work to do so on the policy front as much as on the technology and human services front. So I'm going to ask you to at least consider, and I'm willing to help with this, and maybe the, you know, the ADA folks can figure out some way to create some community of practice for doing this, and I'd love to help out with that. So contribute to regulatory proceedings. It's not that complicated. These things are, you know, a little, you know, dense, and they're dense by design and somewhat out of necessity, but we really need to get more comments from people who know what they're talking about, and that's consumers and the accessibility community at large. We've especially been missing over the past years any voices from the world of dexterity impairment and especially people with cognitive disabilities. They're very late getting those needs injected into these proceedings. There's a lot of ways of improving that, and if you have a mind to do that, I hope you'll get in touch somehow or just start doing stuff on your own. There are more proceedings on the way. I mentioned the ADA, CBAA, 508, 503. This is always going to be churning. Some of these proceedings are not explicitly about accessibility. So for example, we have an E-rate proceeding coming out of the FCC. So this is the discount for schools and libraries on broadband services. Well, I've always wanted, you know, I've always wondered why there's no accessibility monitoring of the recipients of that funding, which is multiple billions of dollars a year, it would be nice to just have some sort of checklist about the accessibility of the facilities of the institutions that receive that kind of funding. And as I was saying before, it's getting easier and easier to make complaints. It's also getting easier to share complaints. If you or a client of yours has something to complain about, don't just contact the official channel. Make sure that other people know about it, because you'll probably get people piping up and saying, yeah, I had that same problem. What are we all going to do about it? And that's a real market motivator right there, is to show to the providers of this great technology that it's not just one person having this problem. There's a lot of folks, and you know, not to be confrontational about it, but just to be clear that we've got some market power here. So the Rehab Act reauthorization is going to be an interesting show to watch on the Senate side. I don't know what much can be done on the House side, or you know, what the timetable is going to be on that, but that's worth paying attention to. If you have a way of reaching your congressional delegation and some particular ideas that you want, or things that you want reinforced, they're receptive to these messages because they get so few comments. Then on the program side, not the laws and regulations side, there's just an awful lot going on in you know, these programs like Medicare, Medicaid, voc rehab, and education. As we move to mainstream solutions, you know, what is it about a piece of educational technology that's not explicitly assistive technology, but it has this great potential for use? What is it that our schools can be doing when we're thinking about buying tablets, or we're thinking about moving to cloud computing? How can we maximize the accessibility there? And we all have to kind of jump in and add that voice to those decisions. We've got a new administration on community living, which we've already been asked to do a briefing on technology, and this is a combination of people with disabilities and seniors. So the opportunity here for a not a medical model view, but a functional model. You know, what is it that someone's having difficulty with? Why are they having trouble, let's say, shopping, you know, for groceries? What is it about that? And what technologically is, you know, either available now or on the way that might improve their opportunities for continuing to live in the community? We've got a lot of state and local technology programs that can always do more on the mainstream side. Your state independent living councils, programs that you folks are work for and with, and these equipment distribution programs, the conventional ones that were TTY and are now looking for, you know, what to do beyond the TTY, and the new deaf-blind equipment distribution programs that all could do with more grassroots participation and more attempts to collaborate and work together. Then on the implementation side, so, you know, let's say you're working in a school or you're working in a state agency. Well, when your organization is buying ICT out there, is there a voice for accessibility? Are you able to get onto a buying committee or a recommendation committee and just authoritatively request information from the vendor? You know, more and more now, vendors are, they're recognizing the acronym. You know, when they heard VPAT 5 years ago or 10 years ago, they didn't know what it meant. And now they're more and more familiar with it. Many of them are posting it on their website. Sometimes it's only available as part of a purchasing contract process. But whatever it is, the more they can hear that message and the more you can follow up with specific questions, the better. And this could be a AT compatibility question, or do you know any users who use, you know, JAWS 11 with this product? Can you put me in touch with them so that we can compare notes? All of that that increases the visibility of accessibility and creates this community of practice. And then I just close with a word about the information resources, which are, you know, as you get more profuse, information becomes the limit to getting the right stuff and for the right person at the right time. You know, if you're at a buffet and there's only two or three things there, you don't have to share much information. It's all laid out there. But if you're at a buffet that has, you know, 100 tables and steam tables and, you know, salad bars and what have you, then you've got to find out what's out there. So anything that could be done to improve how information is collected and shared, and I gave that FCC clearinghouse as an example, but we know we've got dozens of formal information sources like the Job Accommodation Network and Able Data and AssistiveTech.net and others from the, you know, the established AT side of things. And then now we've got all of these grassroots, these wonderful blogs and Pinterest boards and listservs that may have a narrower view or they may have a disability specific view. Incredible amount of information that's out there, it's just not circulating widely enough. And so anything that you can think of doing that magnifies and multiplies the dissemination value of those information resources would really be valuable. So I hope I've been able to communicate some of the issues that I think are important. We've got a little bit of time left, and I got a question right here. Can you provide information on getting involved in the regulatory proceedings? Yeah, I was kind of, as I was building up to that big selling job, wondering what the next step could be, and I don't want to dump this in Janet's lap, but maybe we can develop some, you know, just a little website or a listserv function that just says, here's what's going on. And there are some already. You know, the Burton Blatt Institute publishes a policy newsletter. So does the Wireless Rehab Engineering Research Center at Georgia Tech. But I think what we'd like to have is a kind of, here's what's going on, here are the hot items within it, and here's the easy way to participate. And I think from Victoria, I'll promise to do whatever I can to get that in place. In the meantime, you can certainly look on the FCC website, you can look on the Department of Justice, the ADA.gov website, and the White House also has, you know, recently appointed a new person for public engagement on access on disability issues. So
I'm going to jump in. This is Janet. We do at the Great Lakes ADA Center publish a quarterly bulletin on accessible technology topics. So whenever there's, say, a request for comments on Section 508 or anything that comes across our desk that's a way for public people to get involved in the policy piece, we put that out. So be sure you're on our list to receive that email. There'll be a link within the evaluation for this session. And you know, if you're having problems with a particular company, we can work with you to sort of how you would frame a complaint to bring that up. So I think those are really good points Jim brought up, to let you know that the ADA centers are also a resource.
Other questions?
Jim, there was one question early on that you did address, and I think that what I got out of it was harmonization with WCAG 2.0, but if you could just talk a little bit, really briefly, about in this interim phase between Section 508 being refreshed officially and, you know, a push for WCAG 2.0, are people, you know, is there a reason to go with Section 508 versus WCAG, or what's, can you just clarify a little bit on that, of which standard they should use?
Well, if you're free to focus on the technical detail and the actual user needs, WCAG is a better bet. 508 was always, you know, designed purely for regulatory compliance oversight, and that's certainly what the VPATs are about. In most cases, you know, for example, when I work with private industry clients, they want to see kind of a hybrid view. They want to see, so, you know, what are the WCAG guidelines that we're hitting here or that we're missing, and which 508 provisions would we be liable for, and what could we put into a VPAT? So it's really two sides of the same coin. One is, you know, highly technical, and the other is highly regulatory or you know, managerial. And it's unfortunate that they don't map very well together right away. In the interim, I think it's very contextual. So, for example, I've worked with companies where they only want to communicate with the public through VPATs and through 508. They want to save the complexity for inside their company. So they talk among the developers, they will talk the WCAG language, but communicating with the outside world, that's via 508. And that's unfortunate, but understandable.
Thank you. That helps.
Looks like a question here, understanding that all federally funded agencies to meet compliance issues, we need to caption all video that's on the web. Yeah, I would say that's absolutely true. That whether your videos are training videos for employees of the agency or whether they are public facing, they need to be captioned. Yeah, Victoria comments on the captioning capability within YouTube. There are several ways to caption within YouTube. One is an automated captioning, which just does its best job of guessing what the soundtrack is saying, and that's not usually very good. But the other one is excellent, and that is you send a transcript of what's being said on the video along with the video, and YouTube does a great job of synchronizing the transcript to the video. So it doesn't know what you're saying, but it knows if you give it the words, it can tell you when you said that. And so it puts it on the screen accurately. And there's a lot of tools. There's a wonderful crowdsourcing tool called Amara, A-M-A-R-A, that allows you to establish a team. Let's say you're a school or an agency and you have videos. You can create an internal team for video captioning. And you can do it almost as a hobby. It's almost like a game. You can watch, you know, 10 seconds of the video and type in what you hear and then quit and go off and do whatever else. Or you can stay there for half an hour and work on it. And the more people who work on it, even if their captions aren't identical, Amara does a kind of, consolidation and collation job. So it's really a cool way to do it, and it's being used by the TED Talks and also by, I think, NPR is using it.
Looks like there's one more question. What is the future for providing IT services to students with disabilities, and will specialized assistive technology labs fall by the wayside because of universal design?
Well, as I say, I think there's a great future for providing expert services that take whatever there is in mainstream accessibility and modify it or make the right feature selections and assemble and insert. I mean, you're familiar, I think, with how our browsers work now. You get the vanilla browser downloaded from Firefox or whatever you choose to use. And then there are all of these add-ons. There are these extensions and plugins. And I think that's the model that we're going to be in, at least for the foreseeable future. So what we really need are more experts than we currently have. And this would be, what's the career path for an assistive technology specialist who knows a lot about let's say dedicated assistive technology devices and software, is to move into that sphere where it's more like, I know what this mainstream product is capable of, and for, let's say this student, that will be good enough and that'll work fine. In this other situation, we're going to need a special plugin. We're going to need, you know, Firefox or, you know, some other capability that's plugged in. And that modularity, which the software world has given us, is available in such profusion that, again, it's an information issue. And this is not a hobby. This is a job. This is a full-time job, staying aware and alert to both the mainstream changes and those plugins and add-ons that are more or less aimed at accessibility needs. So I'm hoping that people will be able to make that jump from the, you know, current model of AT services to that more distributed model and mainstream-based model.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Are there any, can we take one more question if anyone has a question? I'll give you a second to type.
I'll say one more thing about the universal design, and that is that, you know, our expectations keep rising. So what was an acceptable universal design solution that worked, you know, pretty well is like the transmission that we had in a car, you know, 50 years ago, a standard transmission with a difficult clutch and hard to do and what have you. And our expectations keep advancing. So whatever it was that worked, we now have options of things that work much more subtly, have much finer adjustment, and address, frankly, disabilities that weren't as carefully identified in the past. So, you know, it's a constantly moving and refining domain, and I'm hoping to see, even in the realm of professional development, how we can begin to address that. I know it's disruptive to the professions, and certainly disruptive to agency funding policy and what have you, but there's just so much there, so much potential there, and the managerial issues are not overwhelming. We just need to kind of grapple with them and figure out how to manage them, and I think we'll show a lot of progress.
I agree, Jim, and this has been a great session. I think we will conclude with that. Please take a minute to fill out the evaluation that will be emailed to you after the session. We thank you, Jim, for your excellent presentation. This session will be archived and available on the website that is listed on the screen. And I thank the audience for their interest and participation, and hopefully you will all get involved in advocating for accessibility in upcoming policy decisions. Your voice is very important. And with that, we will conclude the session. Thank you.